Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. The president gave his first real speech last night to the nation, marking the one-year anniversary of the pandemic. This was President Joe Biden.
I'll close with this. We've lost so much over the last year. We've lost family and friends. We've lost businesses and dreams we spent years building. We've lost time with each other. And our children have lost so much time with their friends, time with their schools. No graduation ceremonies this spring. No graduations from college, high school, moving up ceremonies. You know, and there's something else we lost. We lost faith in whether our government and our democracy can deliver on really hard things for the American people. But as I stand here tonight, we're proving once again something I've said time and time again to the probably tired of hearing me say it. I say it to foreign leaders and domestic alike. It's never, ever a good bet to bet against the American people. America is coming back. The development, manufacture, and distribution of vaccines in record time is a true miracle of science. It's one of the most extraordinary achievements any country has ever accomplished. And we also just saw the Perseverance rover land on Mars. Stunning images of our dreams that are now a reality. Another example of the extraordinary American ingenuity, commitment, and belief in science and one another. And today, I signed into law the American Rescue Plan.
Really? So joining me on the weekend podcast, Bill Kristol. How are you, Bill?
Yeah, I'm fine, Charlie. How are you?
So you've watched a lot of presidential speeches. What was your take on that speech last night?
I thought it was very good, very successful. There are a few things I would have tweaked, but cut a couple of lines, minutes probably, and so forth. But he had the right tone. He was calm and pleasant, presidential, in a kind of folksy isn't quite the right word, but how would you describe it? But sort of
human. It was
human, plain American kind of ways talking to us. And the news was good. It's, you know, he's done a good job on the vaccines. I thought he was smart. I mean, I would have even gone a little less far than he did in the sort of self promotion side, which was pretty restrained by presidential.
Very
standards.
Restrained. Yeah.
But I thought, in a way, the contrast is so striking with Trump. Let it speak for itself, and just but he was good. I mean, he was modest, and I thought the most striking moment for me was when he went on about it's about you. You need to help. You need not more than help. You need to make this work. You, the American people, by getting vaccinated, by wearing masks. He could have even emphasized a little more in terms of schools, by the way in which parents and teachers can work together to make that work. It's such a contrast with Trump, where it's all about him, and apart from the just failed policies of Trump and so forth. So, no, I thought it was effective, and it was effective. I mean, there's a reason. It was effective because the reality has been effective. I mean, he's not making something up, right?
It was not the speech that I expected. I really did expect that it was going to be a little bit more, taking a victory lap on signing this $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. Instead, it was a very Biden-esque speech. It was very, empathetic. Let's talk about what we've been through. And I two things. I mean, I actually had a much more positive reaction than anybody else on our live stream. We did the Bulwark live stream last night, and everybody was sort of, it was fine. You got the job done. I'm thinking, no, I thought that was an incredibly powerful speech because it was understated. So all day long, we had people on, the right media, Ben Shapiro was saying he's president houseplant. He's going to be senile. He can't put together a sentence. And so he comes out, and he's an honest to God, actual, sentient, competent, empathetic president. So, I mean, that was number one. It was also, as you point out, the contrast with Donald Trump. I mean, in every respect, no chest thumping, no narcissism, no whining, no crack pottery, no suggestions that this was, this was all him, that the pandemic was magically going to go away. He didn't suggest, injecting bleach up your butt, to solve all of that. He was sober, modest, hopeful, presidential, and the way that he sort of, wrapped it up, like, we Americans are coming back. And I mean, there's a little bit of showmanship with saying that, you know, it's going to be July 4th and that's going to be our Independence Day. But you could tell how effective that was because it drove the people on Fox News out of their freaking minds.
No, and I think so. I totally agree with you. I mean, so I would say maybe I was a little too qualified in my sort of professional speech writing hat, and it was an A minus, not an A or something. But it was very good, and he needs to keep that up, in my opinion, that in the sense of no victory laps. They should really put out the word that this is when he and the vice president travel around the country, it's the opposite of a victory lap. This is the beginning of the task. They're traveling around the country to encourage Americans to stick to it. Now that we see the prospect of relief from this terrible pandemic, this is not the time to let up, but also that we all have a job to do. But I thought the sentence that for me was the best was something about, not the best, but it was very useful and sort of healthy for our politics was, you know, and if parts of it don't work, we'll revisit those.
Yeah.
And then he quickly, obviously there'd been some fight among the staff about saying that too much, but she can't, you know, and it was quite, but I think it's all going to work, he said right away. Right. You know? So, but he needs to have that attitude. I think people want that kind of experimental, non-dogmatic kind of liberalism. Really, it is FDR. That's, I think, didn't FDR describe himself that way as sort of, you know, let's just experimental. And, you know, not everything in it's perfect. I think if he takes that attitude, and we're going to do a lot more, and we're going to fix the things that need to be fixed, and there's some things we'll probably have to accelerate, or and other things that we can sort of take a pedal off the gas on, and maybe we can open up a little earlier, or maybe a little later. You know, I think that attitude is such a relief and so pleasant, and after both Trump, but also the general insanity of everyone pontificating dogmatically as if, you know, about what is going to happen with a very imprecise, you know, knowledge of obviously of how these pandemics spread. It's not, I don't mean imprecise as a criticism. It's just, that's the way the world of public health is, any serious person will tell you. And also with the economy, we don't know. So I think that whole tone of kind of optimism, confidence, but also caution and
experimentation
is very important to keep up.
No, and I think David Leonhardt in the New York Times had a really good take on this. He talked about hopefulness as a public health tool. You know, that Biden's speech included lots of caveats about the variants, the uncertainty and everything. And clearly his strategy is to underperform so that he can overdeliver. I mean, I think this is where underpromising and overdelivering. I mean, what he's doing is the exact opposite of Donald Trump, who would say, you know, only I can fix this. You know, this is about me. And Biden is like, no, this is about you. And I need your help. But I think that's what made that July 4th thing memorable, Leonhardt says. Even Biden, with all of his caution, seems to grasp the power of hopefulness at this moment, that you need to make people think, okay, we are almost through this. And there is that balancing act. But here's the real
issue. Can I just say one thing on the July
4th?
Please. What struck me so much about it, and this fits very much with what you're saying, what Leonhardt said, is also his vision of July 4th was so, everyone remembers Trump at Mount Rushmore. I think that was the day before July 4th. And then I can't remember, he was on the mall, right? And there was flybys and he was standing there looking like a, you know, little Mussolini. And all Biden said about July 4th, and he mentioned the date as when he hoped we could be back to something close to normal, and said, you know, and I hope on July 4th that you and your families, your neighbors can get together either in your backyard or in your community for cookouts or barbecues, something like that, right? I mean, just to celebrate Independence Day. It was such a modest, traditionally American view of July 4th, non-Mussolini-like, non-authoritarian-like, non-pompous bloviating of the Trump sort, and very much he's not going to be the center of July 4th. Your families, your communities, maybe the local fireworks, if we can go to that level of community, of people getting together, will be the center, but certainly the barbecues and the cookouts, not Joe Biden and not some speech about some culture war speech delivered in front of Mount Rushmore. I think July 4th could be a very big moment if they play it right, which means really underplaying it, I would say. Biden should have July 4th with his family in Delaware or something like that, and, you know, maybe watch the fireworks if they're going to be fireworks with other people, and just let Americans return to a sort of healthy Republican with a small r, Democratic with a small d, kind of normalcy.
I think that packed more emotional punch than some of the pundits are giving it credit for. I was talking to a couple of people who said that was the moment where they actually, you know, had tears because this was that moment of bringing it all together, all the lines, you know, what America can do, redefining patriotism in the sense of, you know, being together as opposed to, you know, the president riding on a tank down Pennsylvania Avenue, well, you know, jets are screaming overhead, all of that. So I think that was a very, very powerful moment. And again, one of the tells was, you know, the Fox News folks, how upset they were about the invocation of July 4th. Tucker Carlson, I want to come back to in a moment. You know, it's like, how dare the president tell us what to do and everything. I think that was a recognition of the power of that, of the power that, you know, if in fact we're back by July 4th, I think we're going to be back before that, you know, what that represents. Okay, so
just one more point on that. I mean, okay. If you think a certain chunk of middle America, let's say, swing voter types, you know, are open to Biden, but worried about the progressives, the wokes and stuff, which they're not foolish to be worried about in the Democratic Party and on the left side of liberalism. Think about that image, though, that Biden conveyed of July 4th. That was not a woke image. That was a traditional patriotic American.
Very much so, which is why it bothered them so much, because they realized how powerful that image is. I mean, I do think, you know, that Tucker Carlson is doing the how dare you, because he goes, damn. Okay, so, you know, we have spent the last year saying this guy is senile, saying he hates America, saying they hate God and all of this stuff, and suddenly now you have this very, very pro-American, you know, American ingenuity, American strength, America coming back. And July 4th, this was not the imagery that they wanted Joe Biden to have. Okay, so other reactions to all of this. And again, I think this is a tell. This is Ben Domenech, who is, how do we describe Ben Domenech? The founder of The Federalist, husband of Meghan McCain. Now he's got himself a new Fox News contract and really feels he needs to earn it, I'm guessing. So he shows up on Fox News after the speech yesterday, for some reason wearing a lumberjack shirt, which I don't really quite know what that was, what that vibe was all about. But anyway, this was what he said after the speech that you and I have just been discussing. Ben Domenech.
This is another garbage speech full of lies from a senile person who thinks that they're in charge of America, but actually isn't running anything. And I'm not going to pretend otherwise.
What? Yeah. I mean, just garbage speech. Look, hey, then give us what you disagreed with, where he is wrong. That was the kind of, that's the kind of sort of, I'm going to throw stuff up against the wall. I hate this guy. And I don't know. I'm old enough to remember when Ben Domenech and guys like that actually had pretensions to be serious conservative thinkers.
I think now if you sort of came, you know, had been away for 20 years and came back and saw that, you'd say, well, does that guy have some issues? I mean, frankly, is there some anger there inside him? But let's not personalize it. Let's just say that about the movement as a whole. I mean, what is conservatism? What is Fox today? It's a bunch of, it's so much anger, resentment, hatred, willingness to express all those things rather than holding them in, even if you have some of that, then express it as vulgarly and as stridently as possible. I guess there's some chunk, obviously, of America that likes that. Hey, he called it as he is. You know, he's not being polite to the president of the United States. He's just saying that the guy's senile. But I mean, A, he's not, clearly, and to say the least, and one shouldn't even have to say that. And B, what kind of country are we living in where that's considered an appropriate comment to make after the president reads quite a good speech, reads it quite well, actually, with two or three of the usual tiny slips that people make. And that's why I do wonder. I mean, I've been pessimistic, as I guess we all sort of have been, mostly at the Bulwark, about, you know, the Republican Party, conservatism. It just seems so ingrained now, the Trumpism, the demagoguery, the populism, the bitterness and so forth. But you do wonder, can that just go on and on and on? Can people live that way and enjoy that for months and for years? At some point, don't people think, oh, it's exhausting and unpleasant, and no one would behave that way in their own family and community circumstances, or most people wouldn't, I don't think. So.
No, they wouldn't. And what's also interesting is that comment takes place on the day that this president has just signed a pretty consequential piece of legislation. I mean, this is one of the, you know, most significant expansions of the social safety net since the New Deal, Great Society, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The defeat of the small government fiscal conservatives, well, actually the surrender, I would say, of, you know, the conservative, you know, claim that they were going to push back against the welfare state, small government, all of that. It's really rather extraordinary. And that so you have the president signing this piece of legislation, which is highly consequential, after the right wing and people like Ben Dominic and Tucker Carlson have spent the week talking about not about the scope of government, the responsibilities of government, not talking about policy, but talking about Dr. Seuss. I mean, it really is kind of an extraordinary moment. So they're mocking this man who has just defeated them in some of the most fundamental ways imaginable. And the best they can come up with, the Ben Shapiro's and the Ben Dominic's, is he's senile. He's a houseplant. Well, this houseplant has just kicked your ideological butt more than you've had in, seen in decades.
Were people, I think you were key among them, Charlie, who said, you know what, electing Trump, and then even more, I'd say, accommodating, enabling, succumbing to Trump, it's going to damage conservatism in the sense of conservative ideas, principles, thoughts about how government should work. And this is the most obvious proof of it, right? I mean, that this massive expansion of government, some of which is necessary, but in a healthier era would have been met by conservatives saying, well, wait a second, some of this is okay as a temporary matter. Other parts are not well-structured, and these parts are really unnecessary, and here's our criticism, and here's where we want to go going forward. Let some of this stuff expire. Let other things get turned into a conservative version of a safety net. That's what a normal conservative party would do. And I think you are going to have slightly bigger government after this pandemic and after government hasn't increased in size, basically the federal government, for two decades, really. And after, you know, with all kinds of things going on in the world, whatever. But instead, there's so little of that. That's what's most striking to me. I mean, you get almost, it's very interesting, actually, as a matter of policy, what's happened. But conservatives could also take some credit, I think, for the fact that they ended up with a $1.9 trillion package is massive, but most of it is distributed in ways that Milton Friedman could have lived with. You know, I mean, that it's checks to people. It's not, there's not a huge amount of federal government central plan. It's not central planning of the economy, right? The massive piece of legislation isn't the Green New Deal. It's sort of, let's really give people more money so they can make it through this period, and so we can also cut child poverty, and let's give money to states and localities so they can get the schools opened. So if you're the kind of conservative who believes in that, empowering people, empowering communities and localities and states, you know, you might not like the amount of money, but actually it's not going to be a whole bunch of, you know, mad. It's the opposite of the criticism. What was the criticism of Obamacare? You know, central planners are going to just take over everything, basically. And there was some truth to that criticism. This, I do think, in a way, lays the opens the possibility for a kind of 2020s kind of public policy debate and public policies that bring together some conservative insights about Hayekian insights about the limits of central planning and so forth, with, you know, to be frank, liberal insights that we have let inequality go too far, that we do need to strengthen the safety net and do so in ways that don't provide disincentives, however, for hard work or opportunity or people or innovation. You know, here you had a liberal Democratic president. You made this point just in passing, but just to emphasize it, praising innovation, science, but also industry, really, right? Talking quite a bit about big companies working together. He could have made that point more strongly. It wasn't appropriate last night, mm-hmm. but Scott Linsicum made this point on a podcast with me. We've had people at the Bulwarker made it. I mean, what is the vaccine success but a tribute to a certain kind of dynamism of the private sector, big companies working with small companies, immigrants making a huge contribution here, globalization. It's a German company that worked with Pfizer that really, the German company probably made the real breakthrough and then needed Pfizer to kind of mass produce the drug. All these things that a certain kind of conservatism with which we would associate ourselves would have said, you know what, there's some vindication for us here. Now it has to be complemented with a liberal emphasis on the welfare, you know, on the safety net and so forth. But that can be done in a healthy way. We can debate exactly how to do it. But that conservatism is barely exists at the Bulwark and it exists in a few places. Actually, so liberals who in a funny way are saying, well, what are the lessons of this? You know, is this a different kind of welfare state that we thought of about 30 or 50 years ago? And conservatives are out denouncing Biden personally in the crassest terms, pandering to ludicrous kind of cultural grievances. There are some legitimate, incidentally, cultural concerns and cancel culture concerns, and those get swamped by the idiotic ones.
Right. I mean, they talk about woke and cancel culture, and they throw around words like socialism, where they've just lost this big thing. You know what? I think part of the problem of confronting this $1.9 trillion program is that there are a lot of things that people look at that and go, okay, we've been saying that we were pro-family for how long? This is pro-family legislation, pro-child, pro-natalist in terms of encouraging people to have babies, to take care of babies, a pro-life movement that is, you know, really focused on abortion. But, you know, and it's true, some of the jibes have been true, that they're, you know, much less interested in that child after, you know, after birth. And now you have, you know, legislation specifically targeted to families, also to provide incentives for work, to support people in businesses. The aid goes to people. So this doesn't have the feel that you are having a gusher of money for what I unfortunately once described as moochers. It is the working people of America who need support right now. It's pro-work. It's pro-jobs. It's pro small businesses, pro-family, pro-child. So even though it's a major progressive bill, there's a kind of an underlying conservative theme that runs through it, which may explain why these poll numbers are so extraordinary. We're divided about everything else, but 70% of Americans look at this and go, no, I'm okay with this. I'm okay with this bill. And I think that's what's making Republicans and conservatives so upset, because they can't figure out what their critique is right now, given all of the compromises they made over the last 4 years.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it does mean, incidentally, that conservatives, even absent Trump and the populist kind of demagoguery, need to rethink things and think about, okay, well, some of these proposals seem sensible. But I think articulating this in more depth, that we want money to flow to private businesses, if money's going to flow to help for macroeconomic reasons, mm-hmm. and to a not-for-profit organization. So, you know, I read that the local Jewish Community Center here is going to get, as it applied for quite properly, and is going to get a small PPP grant, and they're designed for not-for-profits as well as for-profits to keep people employed. And these are people doing childcare and helping the elderly and running a, you know, the kind of local faith-based center that conservatives are always alike. This isn't the Biden administration shutting them all down, right? Or setting up the national, you know, federal center for deciding how everyone's going to administer social programs across the United States. It's the Biden administration saying, let's just give enough money to these existing programs across the United States to make sure they can stay afloat until we get things going again. Now, we'll see what happened. A year, I think we're more likely to be having fights on more traditional grounds against some big government central planning type efforts by the Biden administration. But what's most striking is that the American conservative movement, which really came into being to fight that kind of stuff, inspired by thinkers who had criticized that sort of thing, whether it's Hayek types or neoconservatives in the public interest in the 60s and 70s, is the American conservative movement is currently utterly disabled, utterly incapable of having a serious discussion about any of this. A few individuals and think tanks can do so. And it's both disabled and to some degree has lost the credibility to do so, because we were discussing this before we went on the air in terms of HR1 and other things. I mean, there are legitimate, really are legitimate, you wrote well about this in your newsletter, concerns, complaints, things to oppose and wish that they'd be taken out there. But does the current Republican Party have any credibility in opposing these things until they apologize for trying to overturn the election? Yeah, exactly. I mean, that for me is the key. I had this long conversation with a liberal friend, very involved in Democratic politics, and I was explaining to him what I didn't like about HR1 and some other things, and how I thought they could do better if they focused it narrowly on voting rights and be a strong argument. He said, well, will any Republicans support it anyway? And I said, well, maybe not, but I think you'd have a better case for then breaking the filibuster in limited ways. And it was an interesting discussion, very much like what you and JVL have been having in the news, both on the podcast and in the newsletters. And But at some point, you know, I couldn't say to him in good conscience, yes, most of these Republicans are making their arguments in good faith. I think you and I are making our arguments in good faith. But these are elected officials who went along until the month ago with, they were quiet, and as Trump tried to overturn the election, went along with everything for 4 years, who still haven't repudiated what Trump tried to do or what their colleagues tried to do. The House Republican Conference has not said it was wrong that a majority of us tried to overturn the election. How can you go with a straight face to Nancy Pelosi and say, you know, you should take more seriously these objections of your Republican
colleagues? This is exactly the internal conversation that I had. It's funny that you had mentioned that, because, you know, I was preparing to go on somebody showed it to talk about this and, you know, the need for a compromise. You know, and I would like to be able to say that, look, election integrity needs to be bipartisan. You want members of both parties to have confidence that the system is not rigged, that it is fair, free, and secure, right? You want that kind of a nonpartisan consensus. Therefore, that's why you would want to have compromise. But then I come up with the exact same argument. But how can you seriously argue now the Republicans at the state level or the congressional level are dealing with this issue in anything remotely like good faith? I mean, they clearly are on this voter suppression binge. They clearly are still unwilling to jettison the big lie about this election. And as I've said on this podcast before, I mean, Republicans have clearly internalized the idea that not everybody should vote, that it's not a good thing to have too much democracy. And therefore, they're going to make it as difficult for certain people to vote as possible. So given that, and given what's happening right now, and I mean, this largest restriction, what may turn out to be the largest restriction in the franchise since the end of Reconstruction, I mean, how do you argue against radical action at the federal level? So I'm very torn about this.
And here I think there is a bit of a failure on the part of the Republicans we like, if I could put it that way, the ones who voted for impeachment, for conviction, who stood up to Trump at different times, who behaved in a personally pretty honorable way. But they still think somehow we can go back to, okay, well, look, they tell themselves I behaved honorably, which is true, and to their credit. And I criticized some of my peers in real time on January 6th and so forth. And now we're just going to go ahead and, you know, vote as a mass against the COVID bill and against HR1. And we're not going to even bother offering like an amendment or be serious about saying what parts are acceptable and what parts aren't. We're just going to say, hey, this is all terrible. This is a regressive wish list, federalism and stuff. I mean, in the real world, Republicans at the state level are trying to, in a very serious way, roll back voting rights and access to the polls. And if you're not willing to say these things shouldn't happen, they shouldn't happen at the state level. It'd be better if they were just blocked at the state level. But if they're not going to be blocked at the state level, we're going to have to be serious about some federal legislation to preserve the vote, the ballot, the suffrage for our fellow Americans. Now, having said that, so I'm going to say that, and I'm going to criticize those Republicans who are trying to roll that back. If you say that, I think you have the credibility to then say, now can we sit down and talk about these parts of the bill that the ACLU doesn't like, and that, you know, really are, and the Supreme Court may well toss out, and that are ill-advised. But even the good Republicans in Congress, because they're still in a kind of going forward in a Republican mindset. And I would say this is true of a lot of people in think tanks, too. Unless you're willing to really, in my opinion, denounce kind of what's happening in real time, among many Republicans, unfortunately, let's say most Republicans, really, you know, very hard to then say to the Democrats or the liberals, you know, who are involved in these efforts, you know, you really need to be very concerned about this stuff at all. I mean, this is what you predicted. It's what JVL predicted. Trumpism corrupts.
Totally.
The continuing accommodation of Trumpism in the broad sense of the kind of, you know, nativist authoritarian populism just makes it very hard to get any of these arguments, including some good arguments, taken seriously. Very hard for me to say to them in a straight face, yes, you need to take this seriously.
Well, I guess my main argument is because I think the threat is so grave that it's important to get something passed. This is not a moment to allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. And if you can get an HR1 that will actually deal with some of this voter suppression, then you need to be willing to live without the other stuff. By the way, speaking of Trumpism corrupting, this is one of the great things about podcasts, because we were going through the reaction to Biden's speech last night, and I had one more soundbite that I wanted to give you as a gift today, Bill.
Okay.
To give you a sense, when we talk about Biden derangement syndrome, or the way that the right wing media is having a hard time processing this particular political moment, one of the best, we can go through Tucker Carlson, we can go through Laura Ingraham, we can talk about Sean Hannity, but Bill, because it's Friday, I give you Mark Levin and his reaction last night.
Yeah, this speech that Joe Biden gave is the most disgusting, propagandistic speech that a demagogue, even a politician, has ever given. It is pathetic. And you'll
I don't know. It's like he's having a normal one there. Mark Levin, this is the worst. This is just disgusting. See, that tone of voice tells me that his main reaction was, damn, this guy's winning. It's successful. And I got nothing.
Yeah, and I do wonder, so it makes you wonder if they really deep down kind of know they got nothing. Does the Trumps, at some point, does the bubble burst on Trump and Trumpism and all of this, and or not? I mean, for short term, the short term effect is worse. I think you made this comment to make him ever now, whether it was already, we were already on the air or
before. Yeah. No, before, but it's getting worse.
It's getting worse. I mean, that's what's really appalling. The fever has not broken, as some hoped, and not wasn't crazy to hope that when Trump lost, or when Trump, or after January 6th, and one saw the consequences of Trump and Trumpism, or after January 20th, or after Biden came in and wasn't the caricature that people said he was going to be, the left wing socialist and so forth. But the fever hasn't broken. The fever's has been accentuated, or whatever the right.
It's sort of like they've settled into a new post Trump, period, where that it's even worse, in part because everybody's trying to figure out their own lane, and you can't just slipstream behind Trump's demagoguery and his bluster, so you have to bring your own. You know, it's like you can't go to the Trump buffet and feast at it. So it's BYOB, and so the Ben Dominics and the Mark Levins are just it's like, you're senile, you're crazy, it's nuts. And Tucker Carlson, I sort of have this image of him like pressing one button after another. What's going to work on the culture war? Obviously, we're not going to be talking about the welfare state or anything, since he's bought into a lot of the populism. So what he's, America is racist against white people. George Floyd wasn't really murdered. Let's spend time attacking a woman that most people had never heard of, this young woman who's a reporter for the New York Times, Taylor Lorenz. Let's devote, segment after segment to attacking her. Let's put on some of these, COVID truthers like Alex Berenson on the air. Let's go after women in the military. It's just, I mean, there is a sort of throwing the culture war spaghetti up against the wall on the parts of these guys.
Does that work? I mean, I don't know. Trump voters, some of them are women in the military. A lot of them are related to women in the military. A lot of them have friends who are women in the military, or daughters of their friends, or whatever, and they're proud of them, aren't they? And do they really appreciate Tucker Carlson saying this? I mean, this is where you do wonder whether there could be, whether that poll showing 60% approval of Biden, so some number of Trump voters are approving. Could that stay? I've been assuming that would fade back to the normal polarization of, 50 to 45 kind of thing. But maybe some chunk of people who talk themselves into accommodating Trump more than you and I would have liked, more than you and I thought was wise or reasonable, who didn't vote for Biden, maybe some chunk of those Trump voters are looking at all this and thinking, I don't know, I think it's great that, the daughter of our friends next door has been serving in the military, and it's impressive, and I admire her for doing so. I always thank her for doing so when I see her when she's back home visiting the folks. And that's not a bad thing, is it? And maybe some of that does make a difference now over the next few months.
I'm genuinely puzzled by this, because generally Tucker Carlson, in his own reptilian kind of way, has an instinct for this. And so I understand why an issue like transgender athletes might be a wedge issue. People with, biological males who want to compete with women. I get why that is a politically potent wedge issue. This issue of pregnant soldiers in the military going after, women in the military feels like you've gone back to 1957 for an issue, last time I remember a serious debate about this was in the mid 1990s. And this was, and no, we've gone through Iraq, we've gone through Afghanistan, we have women who are pilots, we have the new technology and everything. And people are going, what are you talking about? And so
you're attacking Americans.
Right. You're dragging. Well, your tweet, I put your tweet in my newsletter. You know, I mean, you are denigrating American troops. This is the extraordinary moment. I liked your tweet where you said, you know, tonight's a snapshot of the state of American politics. On the governing center left, President Biden announces the vaccine will be available to all adults by May. On the populist right, Tucker Carlson will continue to denigrate Americans serving our country. Yeah, I mean, like, you're looking at a menu of things. What can I do to, you know, boost my ratings against Newsmax? Let's attack men and women who are fighting for their country, who have served their country. And boy, the dunking he's getting, he deserves every bit of it. By the way, speaking of cultural civil wars, Mr. Crystal?
Yes.
We're having our own civil war at the Bulwark. who started this? Okay, this was an unprovoked asymmetrical attack by our good friend JVL, who was on one of the podcasts that you have to be a member of Bulwark Plus to get. Was this the Next Level podcast, or was this the secret podcast? I'm not sure, but it starts off in the context of a discussion of the deeply unfair treatment of Joe Biden's dog. I'm always going to stand up for the German Shepherds and, you know, the controversy about all of that and whether that was a big deal or how people felt about it or whatever. And out of nowhere, okay, we're just minding our own business. I'm just a guy, as you know, Bill, who will occasionally post pictures of my dogs. Yes. Because they're the most awesome dogs in America, right?
And are they German Shepherds? They look like German Shepherds.
Yeah, no, we have Augie. It's his birthday today, by the way. Augie is 4 years old today.
Happy birthday, Eli, Augie.
Who's a giant puppy. He's about 130 pounds, about 1 year old. And we have the old dog, Pete, who is kind of a cult figure in the media. He's 16 years old and going well. And if you ever see me on TV, you see the picture of Pete or one of the German Shepherds behind me. So
Is it an accident that Joe Biden has two German Shepherds and Charlie Sykes has two German Shepherds?
No, it's not. I mean, none of these confirms.
I think a lot of the conspiracy theorists who I've been doubting about you and the Bulwark and the Biden operation. This is kind of a signal, isn't it? Frankly,
we are into the dogs, and you know, if you want to talk about one of the dramatic differences between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, Donald Trump was like the first guy, pretty much like forever, who didn't have a dog, and he kept talking about, you know, they lay down like a dog, or they lost like a dog. He hated dogs. Yeah. Joe Biden loves dogs. What else do you need to know? Anyway, so we're just sitting here. I'm just tweeting out dog memes and stuff like that. And JVL sitting, and he's talking with Sonny Bunch and Sarah Longwell, and he says this. This is what he said.
Deeply unpopular, which is talk for 30 seconds about the Biden dog. I don't think I've ever outed myself on this show, but I'm an anti-dog person. Dogs themselves are fine. I hate dog people.
Okay. I feel seen, Bill.
Yeah, well, JVL doesn't like people much, so I mean.
Then he goes on. No.
I love JVL, needless to say,
he talks about dog people as the people who put dogs in prams and stuff like that, which we don't do. But then there are cat people who put cats in prams, right? I mean, there's all of that stuff, you know. So, and then it gets worse because Sarah Longwell, who could just sit there, you know, and be her normal, sweet, reasonable self, she feels the need to weigh in. This is what Sarah then says.
I think it's pretty preposterous, but I actually have to. I'm with JVL. I'm also not a dog person.
Both of people.
And I just am not. Yesterday I tweeted that I thought people cared a little too much about Biden's dog.
That's a very unpopular opinion. You should
just
never
like,
say that out loud.
Everyone got mad at me and people just kept sending me pictures of dogs.
Twitter is a pro dog. Safe
I've
space.
Noticed that. All right. I've noticed that. And here's the thing is like
George
I watched,
Conway is never going to speak to you again.
Maybe, but I watched the way that people like wield their dogs on Twitter as like shields. Like this is I demand to be humanized on this platform by this animal that I am now going to make you all invest in. We're all connected through this. Anyway, it is just like a black box to me. I'm not like mad at people for doing it. I just don't care.
Well, Bill. Well,
I I mean, JVL and I have worked together for 25 years. I'm extremely fond of him. Sarah and I have worked so closely together for the last 3-4 years. Probably I'm closer to her than anyone else in our world in terms of just amount of time I spend talking to her every day and plotting and planning and working. And it's been great getting
shocking,
becoming such a close friend of hers and her family. So, yeah, I think, you know, you and I are going to have to really go reconsider our allegiances here. Right, Charlie? I mean, what's
you're
going
a dog
on
guy,
now,
right?
You are really a dog person. Yeah. We had a dog. We got a dog. Susan grew up as a dog person. Then we got a dog, a mini Australian Shepherd, about 35, 40 pounds. When our oldest went to college. But that dog, Patches, was such a close part of our family for the next 17 years. Also, we were lucky in terms of his longevity there. And so not quite a German Shepherd, but in the Shepherd family. Yeah. And they are they can be a little irritable and a little nervous with strangers and can nip at people. And I guess that's what one of Biden's dogs allegedly did. And obviously that shouldn't be minimized and so forth. But yes, I'm shocked to find that there's anti-dog sentiment, even here at the heart of the most humane and sensible.
You would think that this moment that we would, you know, have a big tent, and it's not just it's the dog people. So I mean, Jim Swift, he's a dog guy,
huge.
So who else?
He's always tweeting. He's trying to humanize himself. He's trying to humanize himself with those tweets, those photos of his dog Gus. Right.
Okay. So Sarah's concerned that people try to humanize themselves with pictures of dogs. Okay. So can I just raise my hand here? Maybe people want to humanize themselves on social media because they're humans. I mean, all of the terrible things that happen on social media, attempts to humanize oneself, this is not a cardinal sin. This is not the worst thing. This is not a bad thing that people humanize themselves, particularly when they are humans.
Yeah. It was like JVL said, Twitter is very pro-dog. I think actually kind of the country and the world are pretty pro-dog. So I don't think it's just a Twitter phenomenon. But look, I mean, we are big tents. So you know what? I'm going to just...
Yeah.
I'm going to be grown up here and just say we are going to continue to work with Sarah and JVL.
Okay, you've been the most aggressive. Okay, Bill. I mean, I know you're trying to be ironic here, right?
Yes.
Ironic, not ironic. Ironic. I-R-E-N-I-C. We actually had a discussion about that. You're trying to be, you know, the peacemaker. You're the one on Twitter basically saying, and these people hate dogs. They're hating. You know, come for the analysis of public policy. Stay for the hate against dog people.
Can I say that? Yeah. Well, you have to brush them back a little bit, Charlie, before you, you know, reestablish the big tent and let them know that you and I noticed their subtweeting or sub-podcast attack on us or whatever you'd call it. And people who are pro-dog. I mean,
so the only response.
We're working it out here. You know what? The country comes first. Country before party. Bulwark before individual dogs, I guess.
Dogs before cats. But so my response has simply been, and I have not said anything about this on Twitter. All I've done is to respond to Sarah with many, many, many dog tweets, pictures of Augie and Eli and Pete in different phases of their life, pictures of me with the dogs. Now, apparently this, you know, she might think that, oh, Charlie, you're trying to humanize yourself with the dogs, to which my response would be, yes, and you have a problem with that, really, because I think humanization is not a terrible thing. I mean, Lord knows that Jim Swift ought to be able to humanize himself.
You know, this is, I think.
I'll lend you a dog, Bill, because you need a dog to hide behind.
Well, our dog, as I say, passed away.
You need a new one.
We haven't gotten another one, but because we actually were so fond of Patches, that's sort of hard to imagine replacing him. But
it's a good thing, though. I mean, it's hard. See, this is the thing about losing a dog. It is like losing a member of the family. And there are some people who won't understand that. I mean, it was when our dog Moses died, it was like a death in the family. We had a really hard time. And you either get it or you don't get it. But I would suggest, look.
We had a cat too, incidentally. So I want to make clear that I'm, you know, we're not like dogmatically, so to speak, pro dog and anti cat. And
I am.
We're open minded. You know, it's kind of it's the bulwark spirit. A little bit of some cats, some dogs, some people who don't like either. Some people who don't like people, like JVL. We have a broad mix here at the Bulwark. Yeah,
Tom Nichols is a cat guy, and I'm willing to accept him. Tom Nichols, I make an exception for him. But I mean, there are I don't know. I mean, it's like. I tweet out some dog pictures. I generally retweet my wife who has the dog pictures. Right. I mean, I'm not in the Jonah Goldberg category of daily dog pictures, but I'm there for him. I mean, this is one of those issues where, you know, we've had a few minor, just, you know, infinitesimal differences. But Jonah Goldberg and I stand shoulder to shoulder on dogs on Twitter and being dog people. So should we just leave it at that, Bill?
Yeah, I think we're going to just, you know, this is a big tent, as you say, the bulwark, and we're reunited in saving the country from authoritarianism. And we'll live to debate the dog, cat, neither issue another day, I suppose. But of course, I just want to stipulate, you and I are right, Charlie, obviously.
Absolutely. We are always right about this. The dogs are always right. And you should check my Twitter feed out because there's going to be a lot of dog Twitter coming. Sarah, in fact, I ought to tag Sarah on all of this. At Sarah, here are some dogs. So happy Friday. Happy Friday, Bill. Bill, thanks for coming on again. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie, and have a great weekend romping around with the dogs there in Wisconsin.
Well, I do. I spend a lot of actually time doing this, you know, doing the dog walking and everything, listening to people and, you know, trying to come up with the answers. So, you know, and during the pandemic, I have to say that I've spent more time with dogs than with people, which probably explains a lot. People are going, oh, that explains you, Charlie. It's true. I literally have spent more time with dogs than with people over the last year. So drag me if you must. You know, give it your best, but that's just the reality. Hey, and thank you all for listening to the Bulwark Podcast, this weekend's Bulwark Podcast. We will be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.